Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Take an old neighborhood. Maybe it's a little beat up, I don't know. Add money and people willing to spend it. Mix over a period of years. What do you get? Well, for one thing, you get our special project, York and Fig, about gentrification and how it happens. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 1st of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We begin today with a new series, a project that has been in the work for months. That is, well, a little bit unusual. This summer, a group of Marketplace reporters and producers, basically our entire Wealth and Poverty team, went out and opened up a bureau of their own, a news bureau. Not Chicago, not Atlanta, not Dallas or Seattle, but in a neighborhood right here in Los Angeles, about 8 or 10 miles up the road from where I'm standing right now, called Highland Park. Unless you live in L.A., you've probably never heard of it, but you probably have something like Highland Park in your own city. It's a working-class neighborhood that got hot and fast. People with money started moving in. New businesses started opening up, and then everything started to change. That whole process and why it happens isn't new at all. What we wanted to know for this project is, how does that happen? That's what we're going to spend a good part of this week exploring, starting with a quick once around the Highland Park neighborhood with our Wealth and Poverty reporters, Chrissy Clark and Noel King. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Tell me where we are.
Well, we are standing outside of Café de Leche, which is a very popular neighborhood coffee stop. It's been open for about 6 years. And the talk about Café de Leche is that it's kind of ground zero for some of the changes that Highland Park has been seeing.
So this is part of why people are moving to this neighborhood, or feel like it's a proof of concept. Like, okay, there's a café here. I can live here.
The concept is, we should say right up top, gentrification.
Gentrification, which is a word that not everybody uses, not everybody knows the definition of or feels comfortable with in this place, but it is, one way or another, however you slice it, this neighborhood is changing very fast.
All right, here we go. Café de Leche. Oh, man, this is awesome. Closed brick, wood beams. It's packed. Hi, I'm told I want a horchata latte, please.
Horchata with espresso, yeah?
Yeah.
You guys want anything else?
How are the cookies?
Actually really good. We have some gluten-free ones.
No, man, no. I'm just going to go with the coffee, thanks.
All right, $4.
Perfect. How long you been here?
I've lived here for like 20-plus years. You know, I grew up here in Highland Park.
So give me the quick once-over on how the clientele has changed.
You have people walking their dogs at like midnight. 5 years ago, you wouldn't leave your house past 9 o'clock at night. So, I mean, that says something.
Thank you. Ooh, with the pretty leaf thing, too? You guys are good, man. All right, well, we got a boogie. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Be good.
So, in some ways, kind of the change that has rippled through Highland Park started at Café de Leche and has been making its way down York Boulevard.
It's actually funny, really, because you can look at a series of 7 storefronts, right? And you can tell which ones are the gentrified ones and which ones aren't. Junior's Discount, not gentrified. Meridian Mercado de Zeno is gentrified. On this 100-foot-long stretch of York, it's 50-50.
And what we're really watching right now is we're watching the economy change before our eyes.
Right.
We're the Wealth and Poverty Desk. We're in a neighborhood right now where you have both in one zip code.
Right.
And that is becoming more and more common in cities across America.
All right, let's move along. Where are we going?
Welcome to the Highland Park Bureau.
So this is it? This is the Bureau?
This is the mighty Bureau? This is the Bureau.
Look at that. Marketplace Wealth and Poverty, a place for neighborhood stories. Cool. Look at this. It's not much, but it's home. We are, what, like 10 minutes from downtown? So why did you guys have to be here, right? Why did you need the pop-up bureau?
We're here because embedding in the neighborhood seemed like a better way to tell stories than parachuting into the neighborhood, especially when we wanted real in-depth reporting.
All right.
And we thought, if we're going to be reporting on a neighborhood, let's make these people our neighbors.
So that's what they've been doing the past 4 months, with the people and the economy of Highland Park. First-hand reporting on what gentrification looks and feels like and how it happens. Chrissy Clark gets things going.
So right after we moved into our temporary office here in Highland Park, got all the computers and desks set up.
Where do you want these?
Against that wall.
The first question we had was, how did people here start noticing the changes in the neighborhood? What did the change look like and feel like to them? So we started asking, our neighbors.
Like Vidal Reyna.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
He lives a couple blocks from our office.
This is our dog, Flojo.
Flojo.
Vidal grew up in the neighborhood. His parents moved here from Mexico in the 1980s, and he works at a restaurant his wife's family owns, which is one of the oldest in the neighborhood.
El Arco Iris. It's on York and Avenue 57.
It's very delicious. I've been there.
Changes in a neighborhood can be gradual and imperceptible, but Vidal, he remembers the exact moment they became clear. He and his dad are in their car. They're stopped at a crosswalk. His dad's looking out the window at the people going by.
He turns around to me and he tells me in Spanish, "Hay muchos güeros mal vestidos por aquí, huh?"
Loosely translated, that means around here, there are a lot of
badly dressed white people. And I was like, yeah, they're called hipsters, Dan. They're moving into the neighborhood.
Hipster, of course, is not a technical demographic term. Badly dressed is in the eye of the beholder. Vidal's wife actually teases him that he dresses like a hipster.
He was wearing a newsboy cap.
But the thing about these differently dressed arrivals that was most noticeable to Vidal and his dad is that, and this is a generalization, of course, but in general, they seem to have a lot more money.
And that presented an opportunity. Vidal and his dad rent out a couple of houses in Highland Park. Recently, one opened up, and Vidal told his dad he thought they could get more than $2,000 a month.
He's like, oh, that seems a little bit too high. Maybe ask for like $1,500. I'm like, no, we're going to try $2,150 and we'll see. Like, I bet you will get some calls. So far, people are biting, so.
This is the new Beverly Hills. No, I kid you. But a similar. Highland Park changed a lot.
That's Fernando May. He owns an appliance shop a few doors down from our office where he sells stoves, washers, and dryers.
Refrigerators, different sizes.
How is business?
Really, really good.
Fernando started noticing the change in Highland Park in the form of higher sales at his store. As more money comes into the neighborhood, more houses get remodeled and his sales go up.
A lot. Maybe 60%
more. 60%
more.
Yeah, since when?
Since 5 years ago.
But in those same 5 years, something different has been happening to Fernando's neighbor.
Okay.
Next door, Rocio Lopez owns a little hair salon. She's washing a client's hair when we walk in. And she says business for her lately?
Rocio's customer was in the middle of a shampoo, but she helped us translate.
It has lowered a lot. It's come down a lot.
Rocio says her customers,
señoras que limpian casas,
women who clean houses, secretaries, 911 operators.
La gente se cambia de aquí.
A lot of them have moved away from the neighborhood.
Because the rent is too high.
Everyone has a story about the way Highland Park is changing. So it was when the pet store started stocking fewer pit bull choke collars and more fish.
Or when six houses got sold on a single block in less than 6 months.
Or when the hot yoga place opened up. We asked for stories from our neighbors, shopkeepers, people we'd just pass by on the street on the way to the office.
Like Marvin Hernandez. He was grabbing something to drink at our favorite taco stand, La Estrella.
He's 22, works at a video game store. He's lived here his whole life. For him, change means less of this.
Potholes all over the place. My wall was tagged up for 2 weeks at one time, you know, just like, okay, when's the city going to come clean this up?
And more of this.
They're investing a lot more money in the community now, you know? At least from what I see, you know? They're building the park on Avenue 50 in York. You know, they're actually trying now, you know? Doesn't seem like they're actually brushing us off anymore.
As the neighborhood gets more investment, it's drawing people back who grew up here and left. Yanel Santillan, who works in PR, she just moved back. She loves the new restaurants that have been opening up, but she's noticed something. Most of the older restaurants in town,
they have the menu in English and Spanish. And now you go to a new restaurant, they only have it in English. And I mean, it's okay, you are in America, but nobody thought it was going to change as much as this.
This is our delicious homemade chai blend.
For Erica Daking, who moved to the neighborhood a few years ago and recently opened up a restaurant herself.
Which is delicious, but at least for now does not have any Spanish on the menu.
For Erica, the neighborhood change wasn't all that obvious until people started protesting about the changes. She was driving by another restaurant recently that had been tagged with the words,
bad for the neighborhood. And tagged it huge on the side of their building because they're like, you know, sort of a more upscale-looking French restaurant.
She says when she saw that message, it scared her.
I was like, man, are we going to get that kind of reaction? And you understand, and at the same time, it makes you feel so unwelcome.
So there's this tension that comes with the changes to the neighborhood. Who belongs, who doesn't, who's good for the place, who's not.
Yeah, I actually moved to Highland Park a few years ago myself. I rent a little duplex, and it's hard not to notice the tension. It's in the air.
And in fact, our little pop-up office got a taste of the tension delivered right to our front door not long ago. We, too, got tagged.
So we are looking at this. I guess we know that we're really in the neighborhood now. We're looking at the door to our storefront. On the glass, in bright orange paint, it says, "Gentrifiers!" Exclamation point.
Someone had painted this on a bunch of new storefronts all over the neighborhood.
And it raised a really good question. Who is a gentrifier? Who or what is responsible for all these changes?
There are lots of things you can point to, but most of them have to do with money. And for the next week, it's that side, the money side, that we're going to look at. The business of gentrification.
From a grandmother on a budget to real estate developers and Wall Street investors. In Highland Park, Los Angeles, I'm Chrissy Clark.
And I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Our project about Highland Park and how it's changing is called York and Fig, after the intersection at which our bureau sits, York and Figueroa. There's also a whole website you're going to want to check out. Video, still pictures, audio, the whole smash. It's at yorkandfig.com. Let me say that one more time, yorkandfig.com. On Wall Street today, much wailing and gnashing of teeth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Coming up.
Being able to uplift a neighborhood without necessarily uplifting the people.
Some of those residents of Highland Park we were just telling you about on what gentrification means to them. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 51 points today, 0.3%, ended at 17,776. The NASDAQ down 64 points. That's 1.3%, closed at 47.27. The S&P 500 slipped 14 points, 2/3%, wrapped things up at 2,053. More fallout from falling oil prices today after OPEC's decision last Thursday to keep on a pump. And independent oil producers are feeling some pain. Oasis Petroleum, a big operator up in North Dakota in the Bakken field there, dropped 7% today. That makes it 32% since the OPEC announcement. Goodrich Petroleum, a player in Texas and Louisiana, down 21% today, nearly 50% since Thursday. Black Friday blues gotcha. Walmart slipped 1.5% today. Target's price was cut 1.2%. Best Buy down 5%. Amazon dropped nearly 4% as Moody's, the credit rating service, knocked it for taking on more debt. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose. The number you're looking for here is 2.23% on the yield. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for October. Did you spend part of your Thanksgiving weekend on a car lot? U.S. automakers are scheduled to release November sales. And the Capitol Christmas tree lighting ceremony takes place. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Congress is back at work this week, which means the annual end-of-year scramble to do some very basic governing is once again upon us. The topic du jour for the next 10 days, at least, is the federal budget and the passing thereof. The deadline is December the 11th, and the name of the game this time around is Cromnibus. Seriously. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes it from there.
Yep, you heard Kai right. He said Cromnibus. It's part omnibus, that is a long-term funding bill, and part continuing resolution, or CR, for short-term funding. CR plus omnibus equals Cromnibus. It also equals
more congressional folly.
That's Norm Ornstein, a resident scholar at the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute. He says the Republican base wants to fight President Obama's recent executive order on immigration. So the GOP would reportedly fund the Department of Homeland Security, which is carrying out the order, for just a few months. But Ornstein says there's just one problem. Some DHS funding comes from fees.
They can't shut down spending directly for a program that's supported by fees.
But the Cromnibus would at least let the GOP put off the immigration confrontation until it takes over both houses of Congress in January, kicking the can down the road as usual.
That's what Congress does. It kicks cans down the road, and that road is really littered with cans.
That's Jack Pitney, a political scientist at Claremont McKenna College. He says Congress was supposed to get the budget done months ago. Congress's dithering affects government productivity, according to Paul Light, who teaches public service at NYU.
It slows down the agencies. It costs us money. Whole subunits of agencies stand in the cold wind waiting to find out what they're going to get.
There is some good news. Even with all these shenanigans, Light does not think there'll be a government shutdown. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The headline economic number of this Monday was a death notice of sorts, an 11% drop in Black Friday sales. Setting aside for just a moment the notoriously unreliable nature of day-after-sales statistics, one might just as well say that Black Friday is dead. Call it a victim of Gray Thursday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday. You get where I'm going with this, I hope. In other news of capitalism, oil actually rose on this Monday on fears that American shale oil production might be slipping. The Russian ruble got walloped because before oil rose, it fell to five-year lows. And the Russians, as we know, have plenty of oil. Yes, indeed, free markets are an amazing thing. Not far behind outright hacking as a leading threat of the digital age comes phishing. That's with a PH, scammers trying to get you to click on a link or visit a website that will capture your password and let them do bad things with whatever access to your accounts they get. A story in the New York Times today turns that narrative a little bit sideways, though. It's about a report from a cybersecurity firm saying a group of hackers has been targeting publicly traded healthcare and pharmaceutical companies for more than a year now. They're apparently trying to get clinical trial results or safety reports or internal audits, pretty much anything that might affect the company in question's stock price. Nicole Perlroth had the story in the Times this morning. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
These people in your article and this report, they are not your average Nigerian businessman scammers, are they?
No, they're not. And they're not your usual Russian or Chinese hackers right. either.
And the thing that makes these folks stand out is that they are sophisticated in terms of the language they're using, in terms of the approaches that they're taking. Yes?
That's right. So usually it's pretty easy to spot what's known as a spear phishing email at this stage,
right,
one of
right.
these emails that hackers send you. Usually they contain misspellings or the English is broken, or even if it's sent from someone you know, it doesn't sound like that person. In this case, the emails are written in native English, and beyond that, they also use Wall Street vernacular and trading lingo. And according to the security researchers that first discovered these hackers, they think that they're actually former iBankers, or at least have
wow.
worked in the investment banking industry themselves.
Hmm. And the victims, the targets, I guess, are executives, are officials at healthcare companies, those kinds of people?
Yes, it kind of ran the gamut, but it was senior executives, people, CEOs at healthcare companies. Hmm. General counsels at healthcare companies. So essentially what they're doing is just trying to get into people's inboxes, and they're not deploying any malware or mm-hmm. anything that would tip off a security vendor or an antivirus product. They're really just digging through these people's emails in search of information that could potentially move markets.
They are also, you say in your piece, they're going through people's inboxes and removing warnings about accounts being hacked and phishing attacks and all that stuff.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. They're setting up rules in people's inboxes to automatically delete any emails that mention words like phished or malware or hacked, so that anyone trying to send you an email that says, you know, I got this strange email from you, have you been hacked, would never make it to your inbox.
The FBI is involved. What about the Securities and Exchange Commission? I mean, these are, most of them anyway, are publicly traded companies, even though we don't know who they are because that has not been released.
That's right. We know that the security firm that first reported on this group alerted the FBI. Mm-hmm. The FBI declined to elaborate yesterday when I reached out to them. I'm actually, to be quite honest, I'm rather surprised that this is the first time we've heard of a group using digital hacking skills for sort of what appears to be insider trading purposes.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do this that I wouldn't be surprised if there's many, many other groups out there. And I hope that the SEC is investigating.
Nicole Perl-Roth covers cybersecurity for The New York Times. Nicole, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
Remember back like 18 months or so ago when the biggest question about Facebook was how it's going to make money? Well, now that Facebook is making money and tons of it, the question has changed to how it's going to make more money. One way might be by changing the rules about all those promotional posts clogging up your Facebook feed. To users, the results could feel like less advertising. To Facebook, it could add up to more. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
For years, companies have been begging their customers and would-be customers to like their pages on Facebook. Once you do, that store or local restaurant starts competing with your friends and family for space in your newsfeed. More and more, Facebook's algorithms filter those posts out. Nate Elliott is an analyst with Forrester.
Ever since Facebook has started selling ads on its site, mysteriously, it started showing a lot less of brands' content to those brands' fans on Facebook.
Starting in January, Facebook says it'll crack down harder on what it calls overly promotional posts, like those that push people to buy apps or enter sweepstakes, or posts that reuse the same wording from paid ads. But what defines overly promotional?
This is a bit of the gray area.
Jim Redden is the chief marketing officer at Spreadfast, a social marketing platform. He tells clients to keep posting, but make sure it's something people will want to see.
Is it going to be challenging to see some of that in the newsfeed? Yes, it will be, and I'm going to have to pay for that. As a marketer, though, I have to tell you, I'm used to paying for reach.
But many companies on Facebook, especially small businesses, have grown used to getting that reach for free. Deborah Aho-Williamson is an analyst with eMarketer.
I do think that small businesses that might have thought that Facebook was going to be a free promotional mechanism aren't going to find that to be the case anymore.
She says Facebook wants to keep its users happy. But this is also part of a bigger trend to push companies into buying ads instead of giving them valuable real estate for free. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Part of what our Wealth and Poverty team did for the series on gentrification that we're running this week, York and Fig it's called, was to set up a recording booth in that pop-up bureau and invite their neighbors in Highland Park to come by. They got lots of stories, which you'll hear over the next 4 days. Also, answers to this question. What is gentrification?
I think that it has to do with progress.
Some sort of like economic upswing.
You know, the rent's going up real high.
Being able to uplift a neighborhood without necessarily uplifting the people.
What is gentrification? Genderfication?
Gentrified, I think it has a bad connotation.
You know, I don't think gentrification is a bad thing.
It's kind of like bringing gentleness into this area.
Possibly better businesses coming in, more affluence coming in.
I prefer the word transformation.
White, Anglo, blonde people, you know, they're moving in everywhere.
Suddenly, children of the couple down the street who would have rented or bought nearby can't afford to. It begins to lose its history.
Something drastically is changing if there is a market that can afford the sriracha, strawberry, mint, julep, chocolate.
My favorite. My favorite.
Same question to you then, not about the drinks, but about what gentrification looks like where you live. Take a picture for us. Tag it gentrification is and put it up on Instagram. We'll check it out. Our whole series, including videos from that recording booth in the Bureau, is at yorkandfig.com.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which does kind of slide nicely into the broad theme of today's program, now that I think about it, money and how it changes things. From a study that we saw in Fast Company, this item, 70% of young American consumers buy organic at the supermarket. Only 20% of them thought they could define what organic actually means. One does has to wonder how many of them live in a neighborhood that, oh, I don't know, might be gentrifying. What do you think? All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow gave up 51 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ off 64 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 down 14 points, 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and Gina Delvac. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.